back to principles of environmental toxicology. Those students who have been with us all semester recall one of the earlier definitions I gave you of toxicology, that it is in fact chemistry at the interface of biology. This part of the course, we're starting to, at least for a few lectures here, transition a little bit more robustly into the world of chemistry. Today's lecture, Abiotic Transformations in the Environment, is actually an environmental chemistry lecture. This and the next lecture, where we talk about environmental chemodynamics, perhaps are a coupled set of presentations that allow you to have a little bit background of environmental chemistry as it relates to chemicals that actually are transported and arrive in the environment and have the potential for exposure within the domain of environmental toxicology. Now, what we're going to do today is we're going to talk about these transformations in these chemicals, the reactions, the what's, if you will, of environmental chemistry. Whereas in our chemodynamics lecture, what we're going to talk about is the why of environmental chemistry, why things happened. You know, if you think about it, we were witnessing an orchestration of events. What is the energy bookkeeping that allows for those events to be somewhat spontaneous or not in terms of environmental chemistry? Today's discussion, what we're going to do in terms of learning objectives, we'll try to have you understand the role of solar photons. These are an energy source, a primary energy source for the planet, and how it has the ability to drive chemical reactions in the environment. We're going to describe in general some of the dynamics of excited states. These are excited chemical states. So at least we'll take you back to freshman chemistry, and perhaps for several of you, we'll actually enter the domain of organic chemistry and physical chemistry in terms of your preparation for this course. But we'll try to explain some of the dynamics of excited states. When a molecule absorbs a photon and becomes excited, it becomes photosensitized. What happens in terms of the cascade of potential chemical reactions in the environment? We'll try to have you understand the major abiotic chemical reaction pathways in the environment. So if we're looking at this in a certain sense, a participant in this chemical soup we call the planet Earth, what are some of the major abiotic chemical reactions in the environment? These chemical reactions will actually, on an abiotic basis, not using a living intermediate, allow for either the activation or deactivation of some potential chemical constituents, chemical toxicants in the environment. We'll try to get a little bit into environmental organic chemistry, and this is a briefing. I'm not going to be asking you within the context of this course to be pushing bonds and electrons around in terms of looking at reactive pathways. We will expect you to understand some of the major pathways to be able to look at a molecule and determine perhaps the most likely sorts of pathways, or if a change is presented to you, for example, on an exam or a quiz, to be able to say, yes, this is a hydrolysis or an oxidation reaction, from very basic principles, typically at the freshman chemistry basis, or within regards to some of the content that we're going to talk about in the lecture. We're going to describe the branches or the types of environmental chemical reactions: electrophilic, nucleophilic, hydrolysis, and redox, oxidation and reduction reactions that occur in environmental chemistry. We'd like to have you summarize the basic reactions associated as well with the formation of the hole in the ozone layer. This will be kind of a focus area. It's just going to be an application of some of the things that we're talking about in terms of chemical oxidation, photolysis, and reactivity, in terms of something you should know a little bit about in terms of the fundamental chemistry. We're not going to talk about it as much. There are some resources on the course website to update you in terms of the current findings. Obviously, there's a great deal of concern about the ozone hole and its dynamics and its impact. I think for the first time, definitely the first time in my lifetime, and perhaps for most students here, the world came together and said, we have done a bad thing. This was an unpredicted consequence of human activity. We did an ex post facto life cycle assessment. A Nobel Prize was awarded to a professor and a postdoc at University of California, Santa Barbara for determining the fundamental chemical mechanisms in this particular process. And the world came together once we understood that and actually banned several classes of chemical compounds that are known to react with ozone. And so we haven't necessarily gotten to the point of reversing this, but at least we have stabilized to a large degree the development of the hole in the ozone layer. Finally, we'll try to have you be able to summarize the reactions associated with the formation of acid rock drainage. And this, again, is going to be a little focus area for you in terms of abiotic chemical reactions. We'll see that there is, in fact, an interface with the microbiology world. So it is more of an abiotic-biotic interaction, but talk about this in terms of its natural environmental chemistry. Well, let's get started with photochemical reactions. As I indicated, all life on our planet comes from the sun and the sun's energy. And the sun has tremendous capacity to change our environmental chemistry on the planet. Endothermic chemical reactions can get their required energy of reaction from solar photons. So the solar photons are, in fact, for these endothermic or energy-requiring chemical reactions, they can get their charge, so to speak, their battery from the sun. Some of the photons, especially in the UV visible range, are strong enough to actually break some chemical bonds. And some of this light is actually available in the solar spectrum. If you don't think that photons can do chemical damage and physiological damage, I invite you to go out on a bright sunny summer day without sunscreen and get a good sunburn, and you'll see, in fact, that there is the potential for the ultraviolet and the high-end visible to actually burn your skin, to actually destroy, via the absorption of photons, some of the cells on your skin. The energy is specific in terms of the two energy relationships that we have on here. It's kilojoules per Einstein in the SI units, or kilocalories per mole of photons in the non-SI unit. But what you can see is that this number is actually inverse to the wavelength. And so there is a wavelength relationship to energy, okay? And the shorter the wavelength, the higher the energy for a particular photon. One of the things most of us should have done at this point in time is reviewed the electromagnetic spectrum. This is perhaps grade school or middle school, but you may not know it in terms of its overall relationship to what we observe in our daily lives, which is typically the visible spectrum, and this is about 0.4 nanometers to 0.7 nanometers. This is the colors of the rainbow. This is what we see in terms of visible light. Infrared light or heat light up here has a lower energy photon, and a higher energy photon being the ultraviolet. But what we experience on the planet in terms of the visible spectrum and even the UV and IR is actually a very small part of the overall electromagnetic spectrum. And so if we take a look at all of the range of potential wavelengths, we, for example, use microwave ovens. These are wavelengths, very long wavelengths up at this wavelength range, as opposed to the higher energy ultraviolet, X-rays, and gamma rays, the gamma rays and X-rays associated with nuclear processes. These gives you an idea of some of the potential for reaction, typically because the photons are more energetic as we go down here in this direction. What we find is that this is where chemical reactivity happens. And so in the IR, we may be able to heat up a molecule, but we're not going to break it up. We're not going to photolyze this particular chemical. I put a picture in here. I've got a collection of various types of pictures. I like this one because in the back we have a large power line and a rainbow crossing this particular shot. This one is actually in South Africa. It's an interesting picture, a very colorful picture, but again, the idea is to give you a relationship between light energy and the potential for chemical reaction. Now, many of us in our chemistry classes will have identified that there is a potential for what is called photochemistry, and this happens when a molecule absorbs a photon. Many of us have, for example, seen black light posters. Black light is more of a UV type source, even though it's a low energy UV, and it allows for the colors, the fluorescent colors, to absorb a photon in the UV, but then spit it back out in the visible so that we can see a pattern in a fluorescence process that we couldn't see in normal natural visible spectrum light. Photon absorption is a quantum event, and so essentially we have learned that you need a photon of a particular energy to excite a energy level within a specific molecule or atom. So these specific energies are required for excitation and reaction, and they are a characteristic of the molecule. This is a basic principle. It's a basic principle of quantum mechanics. It's almost like going to a store where the price of the items in that store is non-negotiable. And so if it says that this particular product costs a dollar, you can't say, well, all I have is 95 cents. Is it close enough? In quantum mechanics, the answer is no. You need to have your dollar. So you need to have certain amounts or quanta of energy to have the process move forward to excite the molecule into an excited state. For example, infrared absorption corresponds to vibrational excitation of chemical bonds. So when we heat up our food, whether it be by an infrared lamp, a cooking lamp, or we're actually heating just by infrared light, or via some other processes like cooking where we have other passive transfer of infrared energy, these will have to do with absorption of vibrational energy corresponding to those chemical bonds. Now, the major classification that we're concerned with in environmental chemistry because of the reactive pathways to create or destroy chemicals of environmental concern is UV absorption. And it corresponds to electronic excitation. That means we're going to excite the electrons into excited states. Usually these are lone pair, which are N electrons, and N electrons, remembering from freshman chemistry, occur on hetero atoms like oxygen and nitrogen. But we can also have electrons being excited from delocalized pi states or double bonds. And so the hetero atom excitation, excuse me, is an N to pi star is what it's referred to. We won't go into the details of that. We'll just label it for now. So an oxygen or a nitrogen, for example, will be an N to pi star transition. We'll also potentially have conjugations, excitations of pi orbitals into pi star orbitals. And so we're going from a ground state, which is a typical environmental state, to an excited state. That excited state may be allowing a pathway in terms of chemical reaction of this compound. Now, in photochemical reactions, this is a complex subdiscipline of physical chemistry, photochemistry. We find that excited molecules can undergo either unimolecular or bimolecular reactions. What's a unimolecular? Obviously, it's something where we have a single molecule that absorbs a photon and then can react. And typically, that's a dissociation or a breaking up. And so we find bond breaking. We can find some potential for inter-system crossing because this excited molecule might be able to meet up with another molecule and just hand off its energy. That's a long word, inter-system crossing, but it just means that your excitement is shared with all of those around you. Now think of that situation. And when I used to teach freshman chemistry, I used to have the students stand up and essentially rotate and run around the room, and they are able to transfer some of their excitation to each other. Same sort of thing here on a molecular basis if you need some visualization. In terms of direct photolysis, I have an example here of methane absorbing a photon, and this is H nu, and the wavelength of this is a high energy photon. It's less than 140 nanometers, so this is high energy UV visible, UV radiation, and it's going to go through a unimolecular dissociation down to CH2 plus H2, okay? So it's absorbed a photon, a very high energy photon. It's enough to break bonds. It's enough to dissociate the molecule of methane into two additional molecules. Another pathway in photochemistry is bimolecular, and this is a chemical reaction pathway and typically can involve some degree of energy transfer. And so here, again, because of quantum mechanics, typically only one of the partners in the chemical reaction is going to be photosensitized or exactly appear in an excited state. In this case, we have a mercury atom, and I've gone ahead and given a singlet S0 orbital here, and that's for the physical chemist among us. But it's going to absorb light at 253 nanometers. It is going to then go to an excited state. And I've put this little asterisk up here, and this is a triplet P state, and that's just the atomic orbital designation for that excited state. You don't need to know that. You just need to know that it's in a photochemically excited state. That photochemically excited mercury, and by the way, in your fluorescent lamps, there is a photochemical excitation pathway, a mercury-sensitized pathway associated with the development of the light in typical fluorescent tubes that is associated with the excited state of mercury and the fluorophores that actually appear in fluorescent lamps. In this particular case, we've got this excited state mercury atom. It's going to react with methane gas and actually drop its energy and use that energy to dissociate the methane into CH3 plus a hydrogen atom, okay? And so this is a bimolecular chemical reaction. The chemical excitation of mercury was sufficient upon reaction with methane to actually break the covalent bonds in methane. Okay, so this is kind of a basic introduction to photochemistry. I want to make you aware that these processes can happen. Now, if we take a look at the range of light energy available on the surface of the Earth, and then take a look at various bond energies associated with organic chemicals, these are the bonds over here. So this is an OH, this is an HH, and this is a carbon-hydrogen bond, a carbon-oxygen bond, a fundamental carbon-carbon bond, and here's a halogen carbon-chlorine bond. And you can see that there is a certain amount of bond energy, and these are in kilojoules per mole associated with breaking that bond. Okay, so this is in a relaxed or ground state. It's very comfortable, but you can put enough energy into the system, a quantal absorption of a photon that will allow that bond to break, typically because it goes through some sort of excited state. The light energy associated with the energy related to being able to break that bond is over here, and this is in nanometers. And so as you go from 257 nanometers up to almost 500 nanometers, in the visible spectrum, this is blue-green light here, 492. And so you can see that green light, which is relatively low energy, 243 kilojoules per mole, will break a carbon-halogen bond. As you get down here, 300 and below, you get into the UV and finally into the high energy UV at 257, and you can see that these bonds, which are stronger, require a higher energy photon to break. The quantization has to do with the energy of these photons, and we can go back to that Einstein wavelength relationship in terms of the energy of the photons and do the calculation that the photons here are actually equivalent on a molar photon basis to this energy in terms of kilojoules per mole. Okay, so quantum mechanics says that we conserve energy. Now, I wanted to put together for you, give you a graphical representation of quantum mechanics. This is a classic photochemical diagram. It's called a Jablonski diagram for the gentleman that actually started drawing these. And these are nice graphical representations. Don't get blown away by this if you're not a P-chemer. But in photochemistry, what we like to do is take a look at ground states. And so everything down here at the bottom of the slide in white, if you can make that out, is the ground state of a molecule. Okay? Up here I've indicated in yellow, and this is an excited state. Okay? And what I'm showing you here with arrows are different types of transitions. Transitions from a ground state to an excited state. And now these A transitions are rotational transitions, and they're typically in the far infrared. And so we're exciting molecules here. They're very low energy. The gaps here are associated with the size or the energy of the photon required for the excitation of that state. So this is a rotational excitation. This is a vibrational excitation, and that's typically in the infrared. And this C is an electronic transition to an electronically excited state. Now, if we heat up food in a microwave oven, microwaves actually are rotational excitation of the water molecule, okay? And so that's down here in terms of these A transitions. As it turns out, the rotation of the molecule, because we have all sorts of hydrogen bonding in our food products, as this molecule gets into an excited rotational state, there's actually some friction and some bond breaking, hydrogen bond breaking, that allows for the transmission of heat, and that heat can actually be associated with going to a level of vibrational or heat energy excitation associated with the molecules. But the ones that we're worried about or concerned about mostly in environmental chemistry are C here, these electronic transitions that allow for the presentation of an excited state up here, an electronically excited state, because this is where it happens that we have photochemical reactions and also dissociations. This is where the energy of chemical reaction typically happens. As I kind of indicated that sometimes we can have an excited state, and again, this is a Jablonski diagram of the molecule that we just talked about, and so we have a molecule that is absorbing a photon, H nu, into an excited state. And this is the molecule we'll call M1. And this molecule now has its asterisk, it's an excited state, but what we can do is find a potential for energy transfer to a wholly different molecule. And all we need is for that molecule to have some states, some excited states, that are equivalent to the excited states here. So if energy is in this direction, upwards, on this graphic in a Jablonski diagram, that this quantile of energy can have an inter-system energy transfer, inter-system from molecule 1, a transfer over to molecule 2, and this will allow for molecule 2 to have a reaction. And so this allows for the potential excitation of one partner, like the mercury in the fluorescent lamp, to actually have an energy transfer over to the fluorescent compounds in your fluorescent light bulbs, and then the fluorescent compound then gives off a photon, in this particular case, a photon of visible light that we see and illuminates our rooms and our households. That's how intermolecular energy transfer works in that particular case. The same sort of processes can happen in terms of this collection, this massive collection of environmental chemicals. You need to know that this transfer just doesn't happen in terms of whether or not there's equivalent energy. There are all sorts of rules of quantum mechanics. If you haven't taken physical chemistry, please do, and you'll understand those to a higher degree. These quantum mechanics laws govern what are referred to as allowed or forbidden transitions. allowed transitions, and it has a lot to do with electronic states and some, again, fundamental physical parameters of the molecules. Now, in our processes, our fundamental photochemical processes, we can also have excited states where we have a photoexcitation from one molecule to another. What happens when a molecule absorbs a photon? What happens is we can have nothing happen in terms of the overall molecular state. And in fact, this is the predominant pathway, is that there's all, if not everything is a reaction. In fact, reactions, photochemical reactions, are reasonably rare. We'll show you something here in a few slides called quantum yield, or the yield of this processes. And so typically we require a lot of photons to affect, not in terms of mass, but in terms of just the percent turnover of chemicals that will actually react. And so quite often we'll find that the molecule itself is unchanged, and this is, happens because there can be a vibrational loss of energy. The vibrational stages in those Jablonski diagrams, actually there's a great crossover. And so we can put light into a molecule and have it just heat up. It vibrates that energy away. It can also just do some things like emit light. It can turn around and spit out a photon of equal or lesser energy, right? Because it may have lose some to vibration, but also then spit out a photon. And so these are typically called fluorescing or phosphorescing compounds, an excited molecule that has the ability to remove its energy or release its energy by emitting a photon. There can also be an energy transfer promoting an electron in another chemical species, and this is that energy transfer or photosensitization. So although we have a photoexcitation of M1, the first molecule, it really is unchanged. It's pretty much dumped its energy off to that other molecule, M2. We can also have chemical reactions happening, and again, the energy might be from direct photon analysis and reaction with another chemical, because you're in an excited state, and maybe that will allow a chemical reaction to happen. It can also allow for a chemical reaction to happen after an energy transfer. That molecule itself, or its partner in terms of intersystem energy transfer, can fragment. It can break up into smaller molecules. You also can have an intramolecular rearrangement. Again, you're in an excited state. The molecule was in a ground state or a relaxed state, and so now that you've given it some energy, that energy may allow for a rearrangement of bonds of atoms within that molecule, so the molecule itself will change. Some of this can include processes like isomerization or dimerization. Two molecules coming together in dimerization or isomerization, in terms of just a bond shift within it. It's the same molecule in terms of the overall chemical formula, but significant isometric changes. In other words, the molecule goes from a left-handed molecule to a right-handed molecule is one example. We can have a hydrogen atom removal also, and we can have an electron transfer reaction happening in some of these photoexcitation reactions. Now, I hinted that reaction quantum yield is typically load. Reaction quantum yield is defined as the fraction of excited molecules in a given compound that react by a physical or chemical pathway. And so this reaction quantum yield is just the relationship of the moles of molecules that are transformed divided by the moles of photons absorbed by the system due to the presence of that particular compound, okay? And so this is the efficiency, if you will, of a photochemical reaction. It's called reaction quantum yield, okay? And so, as I hinted before, sometimes the quantum yield is actually reasonably low. Why is that reasonably low? It has a lot to do with the ability of the molecule itself to transfer or shuttle this energy through other different pathways. There are also complexities in natural environments that allow for the transfer of vibrational energy and chemical energy within a particular M1 or molecular system. Think of this model here, and this is a Florida pond I've given you because here's an alligator right here. But if we have an energy source, we'll call it either direct sunlight or diffuse sunlight that's impinging in this particular case on an aquatic ecosystem, we might have some chemical in here, and these green X's here, these green molecules, is our contaminant. These are our absorptive molecules. In most waters, you're going to get some degree of surface reflection happening, a mirroring of the surface. If you look at the surface of a water bright day without sunglasses, you'll squint because of the reflective properties of water. But you can get refractive transmission of light. If you've ever gone swimming in natural waters, even in the in somewhat muddy or dirty waters, typically there's a degree of light that gets through. Even in dirty waters, there's an optically thin surface layer. And depending upon how dirty that water is, that layer can be a variable depth. These reflective particles that I've put here in brown are just that. They can be suspended organic matter, suspended inorganic matter, dirt, if you will. Those can reflect and absorb light. And as you get down towards the bottom, you get an optically thick eutrophic zone. And so as you get deeper and deeper, especially in eutrophied waters, you're going to get less and less light coming through as you get into deep depths. So what we have is the potential for these photons to actually go into the water and actually excite these molecules. These excited state molecules have the ability to react unimolecularly or bimolecularly in terms of their potential for environmental chemical reaction. Some of the photolysis reactions of some chemicals, and I've listed phenanthrene. This is polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon, as is anthracene, nitrobenzene, an oxidizing substance, and 2,4,6 trinitrotoluene, also known as TNT, contaminant in the waters and soils associated with military operations and practice ranges. What you can see here is these are the wavelengths in terms of the absorption for these particular compounds. All of these are unsaturated. They have benzene ring type structures in them. You can see that there is an absorption somewhat similar for all of those. And so this is probably going to be a pi-to-pi star absorption of the two types. But you can see over here in terms of the reaction quantum yield following absorption of a photon, when we actually count up how many of these molecules in controlled studies actually photolyze, they actually go through a unimolecular or bimolecular reaction, you can see that the yields here are in the order of 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 3. So 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000, 1 in 100,000 type ranges are actually going to react. And this has a lot to do with the competitive pathways of excitation, things like vibrational removal of this excitation. So they just get hot in a certain sense. They absorb a photon. They don't photolyze or dissociate. They just radiate out in terms of vibrational energy. There can be indirect photolysis as well in environmental systems. Most of our complex environmental waters and soils have what are referred to as UCs, or unknown chromophores. We, as scientists, use that term because it's just so complex. We can't really define what's in a generalized environmental system. These unknown chromophores are referred to as the primary solar photon absorbers. Now, one of the processes that can happen is that these unknown chromophores are in excited states, and as people study photolysis environmental chemistry, we find that oxygen is one of the most important acceptors of energy from these photochemically excited unknown chromophores. And so what we find is that oxygen, which exists in terms of its electronic state, and again, those of you who haven't taken physical chemistry, don't be too excited yourself about the terminology here, but we have a ground state, triplet state. This is how oxygen that we breathe exists. It's an O2. It's triplet in terms of the spin pairing of the electrons. It goes into an excited singlet state on absorption of a photon from this unknown chromophores that occur from solar energy absorption. That energy required to go into excited singlet state is very low. It's only 94 kilojoules per mole. And so there's a fair amount of this excited singlet state oxygen around due to photolysis reactions and energy transfer from these unknown chromophores in environmental chemistry. There are some high energy sensitized electrophilic, and we'll define what electrophilic or electrophile or electron loving chemical reactions are, but these photoreactants include singlet oxygen. And so we find now that the singlet oxygen that has been produced, because it's low energy and because there's an abundance of these unknown chromophores, there's a pretty good abundance of singlet oxygen. There's also the potential for production of hydroxyl radicals, which we've talked about as being a very strong oxidizing substance that can, in this particular case, be a result of a photochemical reaction, and various peroxyl radicals that also can happen as a result of various photochemical reactions. And so these are high energy, highly reactive chemicals resulting, these are primary chemicals, the resulting from environmental photochemistry. What happens to these in terms of their disposition? Singlet oxygen is primarily quenched by water, and water can absorb that energy. And we can also find that it can help a ring closure called a Diels-Alder reaction with organic molecules. If you studied organic chemistry, you know what a DA is. The low concentrations overall of singlet oxygen in the environment make it less important. The hydroxyl radical, the photolysis of nitrate is a major pathway in terms of reactive pathway. It's highly reactive, dissolved organic matter. Tea, if you will, from decomposing organic matter like leaves. Next time you see a puddle that's brown and leaves sitting in it, this will be a dissolved organic matter, the various humics and fulvic acids. It will be a major reactive pathway for these highly reactive hydroxyl radicals produced by photochemical reaction. Peroxyl radicals are ROOs. There's many varieties. These are not particularly well scavenged by dissolved organic matter on a relative basis. I'm going to give you a quick focus area in terms of reactive environmental chemistry. For most of the students that take this course, the whole analysis and discovery of the concept of ozone depleting chemicals was perhaps happening as you were still watching cartoons and drinking out of sippy cups at home. This was a pretty big deal for many of us elder folk. It was a little bit scary because I think for the first time in modern history, modern environmental history, we recognized that what we did could change the planet. We had seen instances of water pollution and air pollution, but these were typically site-specific problems. Problems that responded in most cases very well to site-specific cleanup and management efforts. with the depletion of the ozone layer being linked to chlorinated fluorocarbons, CFCs. These are materials that were used in as refrigerants in air conditioners, in refrigerators, in consumer products. These particular chemicals, it was discovered, go off into the atmosphere, and this is a situation where perhaps we should have done a better job of life cycle assessment. We should have done a better job at modeling the behavior of these particular chemical compounds, but in fact we didn't. The best thing that we can do at this point in time is learn from our experience with CFCs and the ozone layer to better design systems, future systems that are more sustainable, less impacting of the natural environment. But these CFCs are released. They're released by leaky refrigerants, leaky refrigerators, air conditioners, and industrial processes. I might also say that although we're going to focus on chlorinated fluorocarbons, there are several other chemicals that are known ozone depleters, including some nitrogen oxides in terms of our daily processes. There are some chemical fumigants used in agriculture, like methyl bromide. These chemicals, if they have not been banned or limited, they are on track to being banned and limited. Typically, it's finding a replacement chemical in terms of industrial engineering for these processes that is sometimes the limiting factor in terms of our ability to transition to safer technologies, safer chemicals. CFC elimination was helped along by engineers and chemical engineers and chemists that actually were able to develop a class of chemical compounds that included the basic properties of CFCs and refrigeration cycles, but they did not have the reactive chemistry, the stratospheric reactive chemistry that CFCs did have. Follow-up analyses has suggested that we may not be as clean as we thought we were in terms of these new wave chemicals, and so there's tremendous opportunities as well as concerns in terms of the future and our development of chemicals, especially volatile chemicals, that are ozone neutral in terms of not depleting the ozone layer. In terms of the program, so to speak, of what happens when CFCs are released, they enter the stratosphere because they are volatile. Sunlight produces some breakdown products. One of the breakdown products is hydrochloric acid. Another is chlorine nitrate. And so we have these inorganic compounds. There's a heterogeneous reaction. Heterogeneous is a term meaning that we're going to have different phases. So we have a gas phase reaction happening on a liquid surface, and these are on stratospheric cloud surfaces, so on the droplet surfaces at the interface. So we have a difference of phase, gas phase reactant on a water cloud water droplet. These reactions produce Cl2 or chlorine gas, which is then absorbs another photon and then is photolyzed into chlorine radicals by ultraviolet light. Remember, you're up in the stratosphere where the amount of ultraviolet is far greater than on the surface. The chlorine radicals have the ability to then catalyze the conversion of ozone, which in itself is photochemically produced from oxygen. But in its production, it also is a good UV absorber. Unfortunately, chlorine radicals do catalyze the conversion of ozone back into oxygen. The problem then is that we have decreased ozone levels. This allows for less absorption of UV photons coming in from the sun, so it does increase UV radiation at the Earth's surface. I've given you an update in terms of 2002 diagnostics on the Antarctic ozone hole. You can surf around the web and find out tremendous amounts of information on where this is going. Most people think that the Montreal Pact, and I agree, in terms of banning CFCs, was an outstanding accomplishment in terms of international relations, countries doing good. Coming together in terms of preserving the ozone layer, banning chemicals, cycling them out. Are CFCs still produced and used? Yes, in very limited quantities and typically more in developing nations. But we have rolled back the production and release of these significantly. Now, the cause-effect there in terms of release has been significant. At least most scientists will agree that the results of the actions of the body politic, the world body politic in the 1980s, the mid-1980s with the Montreal Protocol banning CFCs, has been a large-scale environmental success, one that we can all point to as we move on to the challenges, for example, of global warming. But in terms of where we've come, this graph here is the Dobson units. Dobson units are essentially a measurement of the thickness of the ozone layer, the thickness and density. And you can see in this particular graphic, 1979 to 2001, at least we have stabilized that thickness. It is no longer decreasing at the rapid rate that we saw before we banned those chemicals. We can also see at least a plateauing as well in the size of the Antarctic ozone hole. This is 79 to 2001. We're getting up into the mid to high 20s. I think last year was 28, but at least we're not in this rapid change zone. Most scientists that have modeled this think that it's going to take about 50 years or more for this trend to reverse itself. Fortunately, perhaps we are at a place where there is not a lot of biology happening. The interaction of high-energy UV and biology is significant. However, what we do find is that the higher energy photons that hit the surface of the Antarctic do cause an increase in ground surface heating, as it is a major ecological resource in terms of water, ice, and in terms of a local ecosystem. There is the potential for this Antarctic ozone hole to impact the Antarctic ecology and the water dynamics of this particular environment. Let's get back to environmental chemistry and let's review the different types of abiotic reactive pathways that can happen in environmental chemistry. I've introduced the term several times in the course electrophilic or an electron loving. We also have nucleophilic reactions. We have oxidation reactions. We have reduction reactions and other various abiotic pathways. Those of you who have taken a significant amount of organic chemistry recognize these terms, have a good capacity to kind of understand them as we apply these organic molecule reactions to environmental chemistry. But for the purposes of just reviewing here, we'll go through these and just try and get a handle on these particular pathways and how they relate to chemistry and therefore toxicology. In terms of nucleophilic and electrophilic reactions, you know that covalent bonds between atoms are based on electronegativity, and typically they're polar. When we look at freshmen in organic chemistry, we see these electropositive carbon atoms, and so we've put a delta plus on those and a delta minus for an electronegative atom. And so there is a charge distribution there in terms of electronegativity from one atom to another in this covalent bond. They can be the sites for chemical reaction. Nucleophilic reactants are reactants that are seeking positive, and so this will be a nucleophilic reactive site. Electrophilic reactants will be negative seeking, and so electrophilic reactants will be seeking this side of the covalent bond. What we find when we take a look at environmental chemistry is that most of the chemicals in the environment, the natural world around us, aquatic ecosystems for example, most of these species are species that chemically react with organic molecules as nucleophiles. Okay, and so they are essentially positive seeking chemical reactants. These are the chemicals that are abundant in the environment. Environmental nucleophiles are many. They are typically inorganic and they are abundant. Because of this abundance, electrophiles are short-lived, as it turns out, and the reactions of organic compounds with electrophiles are usually photochemically or biologically induced. As we go down this list, a fairly comprehensive list of environmental nucleophiles, you'll see water on here, perchlorate, this is mostly a synthetic compound, acetate, sulfate, hydroxide ions, cyanide, phosphates, can function as environmental nucleophiles. One thing you notice is that these all have negative charges with the exception of H2O, which does have a fairly polar distribution of its electronegativity. Now, nucleophiles, nucleophilic species, have full or partial negative charges. When encountering an organic molecule with a polar bond, what happens is the electron-rich atom of the nucleophile can then form a bond with the electron-deficient atom of the organic molecule, and typically we find in these reactions that the organic molecule has a leaving group. Since water is the most important environmental nucleophile, especially as OH minus, the hydroxyl part of the water hydrolysis reaction that dominates our pH expression, what we find is that hydrolysis is actually the nucleophilic reaction of most importance in environmental chemistry, and it does transform the organic molecule into a more polar molecule, more water-soluble molecule. There are two basic pathways or models for nucleophilic substitution. This is taking you back to your organic chemistry discussions. You probably will recall SN1 and SN2 reactions, SN1 being substitution, nucleophilic, unimolecular. S, substitution, and nucleophilic, 1, unimolecular. And in this particular type of chemical reaction pathway in the environmental chemistry, water hydrolysis is the dominant pathway. What we have is we've got some organic molecule here, perhaps with a halogen group. Remember that we've got electronegativity, so we're going to have more of a negative charge out. In this case, might be a chlorine atom. The carbon will be electropositive. This particular step here in terms of this excited disposition or this metastable state will be an RLS or a rate limiting step. If you recall from your discussions in organic chemistry, you can then have a nucleophile come in such as an OH minus that actually is going to displace in a unimolecular basis. So this unimolecular metastable state is why it's called an SN1. And this displacement is going to happen such that the new molecule and the new metastable excited state is going to have this displaced atom, in this case perhaps an OH. And finally, we get the stabilized molecule, molecular product. We can also have an SN2 reaction, and again, this is substitution of nucleophilic bimolecular, where we actually have reactive pathway that involves this nucleophile coming in. There's a rate-limiting step forming, again, a metastable state where we have the reactive pathway kind of presuming to go to a substitution. Where, in fact, in the case of water, an OH has substituted and displaced a chlorine. And again, we can also look at this for some types of compounds as being predominantly a water hydrolysis reactive pathway. Now, is SN1 and SN2, these aren't descriptive pathways we assign. It's what nature tells us. It's a part of the nature of the beast, how a particular chemical happens to go through a particular reactive pathway. What we do is actually study these on a case-by-case basis. We come up with designating these as SN1 and SN2 based on things like spectroscopic evidence, where we can identify these metastable intermediates, these different excited states, and this gives us an idea of how the mechanism of the particular chemical reaction is occurring. Some of the hydrolysis mechanisms that we've studied in terms of potential chemicals in the environment, if X here in these chemicals is a halogen, for instance, in this particular case, chlorine, the hydrolysis of this particular chemical compound is about, the half-life is 340 days. Laboratory analysis suggests this goes by an SN2 reaction. This particular chemical, as we put on a chain here, is about 38 days. As we get down here to some other chemicals, including this one, which has a benzene ring, so this is a chlorotoluene. This is by an SN1 reactive pathway, and its half-life to hydrolysis, again, the replacement of this chlorinated moiety to hydroxyl, is on the order of 15 hours for its half-life. Now, there are other abiotic reactions. Your textbook goes through and describes some of these. I won't go into depth other than, you know, these are things you need to be aware of. Alkylation, this is where aliphatic molecules can develop a positive center, and that can be an alkylating agent in an electrophilic reaction with a nucleophile. We can also have a process called beta elimination, and this is where a beta carbon adjacent to a group, to a nucleophilic reaction at an alpha carbon can actually react and essentially be kicked off. And so it's almost a chain reaction down the molecule. The reaction happens at this atom, but in fact there's elimination transfer beta to that to the next atom over. We can have a chlorination, especially with excited state chlorine, with various aliphatic carbonyls and amines. And again, there's a wide variety of potential abiotic reactions given concentration and of not only the target chemical, but also of the reactants, and as well sufficient energy to make that go through. We can find tremendous variety of reactive pathways, typical of some of the reactive pathways available and discussed in organic chemistry classes. Another pathway is oxidation. In freshman chemistry, it's defined as a loss of an electron or the introduction of an oxygen into a molecule. I always like to tell students, remind students, that combustion is best defined as combining with oxygen. I do recall a book one time, God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, by Kurt Vonnegut, talks a lot about firemen and how firemen are the last American heroes. But I remember a quote in that book that the fireman's job is to keep you, your property, and your loved ones from combining with oxygen. In terms of oxidation, we have many atmospheric oxidants because of the interaction of solar photons and oxygen. These can dissolve in water. They can dissolve in water in atmospheric water and also in terrestrial water. We have triplet oxygen, which is the ground state of oxygen, of atmospheric oxygen. Typically, those of us that have taken organic or physical chemistry usually recognize triplets as excited state, but for oxygen O2, it's the opposite. Singlet state oxygen is an excited state. There can be oxygen atoms, highly reactive. There can be ozone, another highly reactive oxidant, has a electrochemical potential sufficient to bleach many things. We use ozone, for example, to disinfect water. Hydroxyl radicals, one of the strongest free radicals on the surface of the planet. It can be a photochemical byproduct because it is such a strongly oxidizing substance. It is highly reactive, will oxidize most things it comes in contact with. Nitrogen dioxide is another photochemical oxidant, atmospheric photochemical oxidant, that can actually be dissolved in water. We can also, in terms of environmental chemistry, follow reductive pathways. Reductive pathways are the gain of an electron or a hydrogenation. There are several natural reducing agents, and typically a reducing agent is something that has the ability to be oxidized, and so it can donate an electron. So it's a battery. And so ferrous iron, Fe2+, has the ability to be oxidized to ferric iron, and in the process donate an electron. And this is one of the bases for hemoglobin, if you recall. Other reducing agents include hydrogen sulfide, various iron porphyrins, sulfhydryl compounds, hydroquinones, and hydrated electrons themselves. Some of the reactions that can happen out in environmental chemistry of interest include reductive dechlorination and nitro group reduction. And so these are chemical reactions. These are abiotic chemical reactions. Sometimes we find that they are assisted by various enzymes and catalysts that occur out in nature. I've given a chemical reaction down here of DDT. You can see that this is fully chlorinated, but in this particular reduction, it's gaining two electrons and a hydrogen, and it's going to DDD one of the metabolites. The next step would be removal of another chlorine to DDE. DDD and DDE are the primary metabolites you find in your own body fat from DDT exposure through the liposphere. Another category is of chemical reactions of interest in environmental chemistry, abiotic chemical reactions, are redox reactions. And this is the chemical reactivity of electron acceptors, oxidants, and donors, also known as reductants. They can react abiotically in a thermally favorable or an energetically favorable reactive environment with a given particular chemical. That chemical may or may not be present in sufficient abundance in terms of the natural environment. We do find that most redox reactions, even though they're chemically based, are biologically mediated. It's very difficult in terms of the natural world, and I warn students not to be overly enthusiastic about separating abiotic processes from biotic processes. Microbial influences especially will be dominant in many environmental systems. Even though you may be very comfortable with the chemistry of the situation, please be cognizant that the microbiology has the ability to dominate the greater chemical environment in a reactive environmental system. Some of these natural redox processes have to do with essentially the battery, the group of half reactions that are present in these natural environments. Remembering from, again, from freshman chemistry, you have to have a certain redox to be able to have the chemical reaction, redox potential, to have the chemical reaction be exothermic or endothermic. Something that's going to be spontaneous will be exothermic. Something that will be non-spontaneous, that requires energy, will be endothermic. There are multiple pathways. Unlike the battery and the energizer buddy, where you have an isolated chemical reaction in terms of an isolated system, the environment is far greater than that, far more complex. Typically what we have is all of these types of reactions happening, including these are half reactions, these are reduction half reactions. They can be written both ways, but typically we write them as standard reduction potentials. And these potentials have developed out there, but it's the concentration of these various chemicals in there that will dominate the actual number of electrons and the potential of those electrons available for environmental chemical reactions. And so typically what we find is that these are complex systems, there are dominant pathways, and our approach sometimes to monitoring these redox processes is to do simple things like look at EHs or ORPs, oxidation reduction potentials. What is the final potential of the system? And then look in terms of the chemistry at what the dominant pathways are that are driving that potential. Is it an oxidizing system is the question we will ask. Is it a reducing system is another question we'll ask. And those will be good in terms of either making certain types of processes happen or not. For example, on the surface of terrestrial systems, it's a relatively oxidizing environment because of the presence of oxygen and all of the oxidizing species we talked about. Whereas in subsurface environments where we have oxygen poor conditions, these are typically going to be more reducing or anaerobic conditions, and therefore different sorts of chemistry, reductive chemistry, will occur. One of the ways we can understand environmental systems in terms of their redox capacities is to try to map redox stabilities. What we do in this particular approach, and this approach is Port Bay diagrams, there are courses in environmental chemistry and environmental geochemistry that you can take where you learn actually how to do Port Bay diagram mapping. Port Bay diagrams are essentially just a map of the redox stabilities of certain types of chemicals. These are thermodynamic diagrams, and so you have to be very cautious in using thermodynamics because, as we'll learn next time when we talk about environmental chemodynamics, thermodynamics just tells us if it can happen. Okay? It doesn't tell us how fast it will happen. And so our discussion needs to be associated with the possible, but not necessarily the probable, because what might be a very energetically favorable reaction in terms of thermodynamics may actually take geological time for it to produce the other side of the reaction. Therefore, with regards to us, this might be something that we would consider in terms of our understanding of a local or a contaminated environment. This is a Port Bay diagram for lead, and I've kind of hinted at several times in several lectures about the importance of chemical speciation and the variability of different types of species. This is one of the more complex Port Bay diagrams, and so I'm going to give you one that's fairly difficult to start to give you an idea. This is a mapping of the thermodynamic stability fields in an environment. What we are mapping in this direction on the x-axis is pH, and so this is 0 to 14. Circumneutral pHs dominate most environmental systems, and so we're talking about pH 5 to perhaps pH 10, so somewhere in here is what you're typically dealing with natural waters. On this axis, these are redox potentials, and this is listed as EH. This is the redox potential, the oxidation reduction potential, and that's normalized to the standard hydrogen electrode. That's why we have an H here. And so this is minus 1 volt to plus 1 volt with 0 in the middle. Positive numbers indicate oxidizing conditions, negative numbers indicate reducing conditions. Now you can probably just make out here on your monitors here the two dashed lines here. There's one I'm following right here with the pointer, and this is where we will actually reduce water. So below this is not really of environmental concern. For synthetic systems it might be. Up here we have a dashed line here, and this is where water is oxidized. So again, above that is not of environmental concern. As you can imagine, the area of most environmental concern is typically right about in the center. Circumneutral pHs and either slightly oxidizing or slightly reducing environments. What you get on here in all of these different fields is the different types of species that will be most thermodynamically stable. And so, for example, if we start talking about circumneutral pHs, something in a not particularly highly oxidized or highly reduced system, you see that the thermodynamics is going to drive the reactive chemistry in some time frame. Again, we don't know anything about kinetics from these diagrams, to lead carbonate. We can also have lead sulfate here, and where's our lead metal? It's way down here. It's highly reduced. As it turns out, most of the lead that we find in natural minerals is as a sulfide, and that's down here in terms of the reduced substrate, reduced sulfur, and binding with lead because it has an exceptionally low KSP, or solubility product constant. You can see that in highly alkaline situations where you get up in pH 11, 12, 13, you can see that there's a variety of chemical forms that these lead oxides can take. You find also that as we get into low pH, we start actually oxidizing and freeing up, in terms of aqueous solubility, lead 2+. And so we can find lead 2+ down here in very, very low pHs in reasonably oxidized waters. We're going to be talking about acid mine drainage. Acid mine drainage is down on this end of the focus area. Now, this is not all of the substances that are possible in the Port Bay diagram. We haven't chosen all of the various species. If we put in all of the aqueous and precipitated species, it becomes even more complex. And the idea here is not to have you become an expert in lead environmental chemistry, but to give you at least a good sensitivity to the complexity of all the different species and chemical forms of lead that might be available in the environment. We've chosen lead in terms of looking at blood lead and childhood blood lead risk assessment, blood exposure. It's been a little bit of a theme in terms of using that as a risk assessment. If we were to continue that theme here today, you can see that if you're involved in environmental lead risk assessment, this is a fairly complex undertaking because, in fact, you're not just looking at lead, you're looking at perhaps a dozen or two different species or subspecies. You're tracking them in terms of what's most appropriate. But what this does is it gives you the idea that simple is not necessarily the best. You have to have at least a minimal comprehension of the potential for complexity when it comes to species to come from different mineralization pathways and the relative bioavailability, the relative toxicity of all of these different species. Why do we need to know that? Because there are some areas of the United States that are highly contaminated with heavy metals such as lead. We're going to do a quick focus area to finish off today's lecture. I'm going to talk about abandoned mine lands. The numbers here that we're going to talk about are constantly changing. These reference numbers were in the late 1990s. These have changed significantly, but I haven't been able to find current numbers. So typically these situations have improved somewhat, but they still remain a problem. But the former Bureau of Mines, used to be a part of the Geological Survey, the U.S. Geological Survey. There is about 12,000 miles of rivers and streams and about 180,000 acres of lakes and reservoirs severely impacted by abandoned mine lands. And these were not only metal mines, but also coal mines. And again, what happens in the mining process? The mining process takes reduced substrates in the subsurface, digs them up, and what happens is in the mineral extraction process, in the ore extraction process, we turn over a tremendous amount of soil. Quite often that soil contains reduced substrates, which can then react in an accelerated weathering with the oxygen at the surface, and also with the oxidation potential of what's in water and precipitation. There is also a potential then for mobilization of these substrates, and unfortunately, the way things work in mine lands, these reduced substrates typically have immobilized some things that we refer to as heavy metals or contaminants of concern, such as some radionuclides associated with some mining operations. But bringing them to the surface can sometimes release them to be mobilized. One of the telling signs of what's referred to as acid mine drainage, or AMD, you'll also hear the term ARD, or acid rock drainage. But one of the telling signs historically has been the production of these bright orange oxide stains. This has to do with reduced iron pyrites or iron sulfides being oxidized, becoming iron sulfates, and presenting, and we'll go through the chemistry of iron oxidation here. Currently, there's about 500,000 abandoned mines in the U.S. These are being closed and remediated and cleaned up. It's probably still in the hundreds of thousands. This is a 1990 statistic, or mid-1990s statistic, but it's still in the hundreds of thousands. In the western United States, you can go to websites, and some of them I've actually linked on this particular website, this particular course lecture site. In many of the western U.S. States, including Idaho, these abandoned mine sites, sometimes they're quite small, they can also be quite large, but they typically are in the numbers of tens of thousands in several western U.S. states. One of the things we need to know about in terms of understanding acid rock drainage, acid mine drainage, is the solubility product constants for metal sulfides and metal hydroxides. Quite often what we find is that the mineral ores, the origins of these heavy metals, are as sulfide or sulfide-bearing minerals. You can see that the KSP, or the solubility product constant for these metal sulfides, are typically very small, 10 to the minus 45th for copper, minus 10 to the minus 23rd for zinc, 10 to the minus 28th for lead, cadmium 10 to the minus 29th, even iron at 10 to the minus 19th, nickel at 10 to the minus 16th. When you have KSPs, or solubility product constants, remembering from freshman chemistry, that are very, very small, those are indicators of small degree of solubility. And so these copper sulfides, these metal sulfides, these zinc sulfides, these lead sulfides are highly insoluble. Now what happens is, in acid rock drainage, is that the sulfide is oxidized to sulfate, and that then releases the metal in terms of being able to be dissolved in water. So it enhances its solubility and therefore enhances its mobility. The other thing you should know about is metal hydroxides. Metal hydroxides are another form of these metals, and if we have sufficient hydroxide or basic conditions, we also have some KSPs that are relatively low, 10 to the 19th, 10 to the 15th, 10 to the minus 31. What this does is it presents a mechanism that if we add base to these solutions, in the same way you did this probably in freshman chemistry in terms of precipitating out metal hydroxides, environmental cleanup strategies for these metals, these heavy metals, quite often can involve the addition of alkali to form these metal hydroxides. I was once touring an active mine in Alaska. This is about 100 miles north of the Arctic Circle on the south slope of the Brooks Range. And during a helicopter overflight of some incredibly beautiful territory, you have to remember, as I had to remember, that these metal bearing, heavy metal bearing minerals are part of our natural environment. And because there were several places in this local natural environment unimpacted by mining, that had exposed minerals in the surface that were being weathered and oxidized. It was very interesting to see some of the streams running kind of an opalescent white blue from the hydroxide reaction of the normal natural waters with the released metals that had been released from oxidized sulfides. And so here we saw kind of the changeover in terms of natural environmental chemistry of a weathering release, a weathering oxidation of metal sulfides, and then the co-precipitation, the precipitation of hydroxides from the natural pH and buffering and hydroxide of these natural waters. This was a very interesting observation for me. Typically, in acid rock drainage situations, though, we have a problem, and that problem is acid production. This can adversely impact surface water, groundwater, and some riparian areas, and so active coal mining and metal mining operations typically are point sources for the production of acid rock drainage. We'll go through the chemical formulas of how that happens here in a moment. It's common in coal mining regions. Anybody who's been around coal mine, you'll see quite a bit of this orange flock of these ferric oxides, hydroxides. It's a telltale sign. But on the other hand, you can also see this in naturally occurring acid rock drainage in terms of exposed mineral areas. This acid rock drainage forms when these various pyrite substrates, and pyrite is a iron sulfide compound, it's also referred to as mascarite, are exposed to weathering conditions. And again, natural weathering will expose these mineral outcrops. But interestingly enough, as you can imagine, mining operations will accelerate this because of the high amount of soil turnover, especially when the ore, the waste rock associated with ore extraction, has a high amount of iron sulfides in it. The process includes oxidation and hydrolysis. How we look at that here in terms of the chemical reaction, the chemical formula of acid rock drainage is a very interesting one because it can be autocatalytic at very low pHs. But we have this solid sulfide, this pyrite, iron sulfide. It combines with oxygen and with water, and it then releases the ferrous iron and sulfate, but it produces some hydronium ions here. These hydronium ions are problematic because that's an acid production. This is why initially it's called acid rock drainage, but it also releases here, in this case, ferrous iron. Now, I've listed many heavy metals of potential in acid rock drainage, and so although the predominant one and typically in ARDs is the bright orange red associated with iron, we can have mercury sulfides, zinc sulfides, lead sulfides. Lead sulfide is also a mineral form called galena. Zinc sulfide is sphalerite. These minerals can go through the same process. And so when you see iron here, think also in terms of mobilized mercury, mobilized cadmium, mobilized copper, zinc, lead. Next step in this process, because there is a bit of a chain reaction, is the ferrous iron then is available because it's a reduced state of iron. It can be further oxidized, especially with the acid environment, to ferric iron. Ferric iron is that nice bright red iron that we typically see. Ferric iron will react with water, and it'll actually hydrolyze water and take on the iron oxide. Okay, the iron oxide, because you've taken the pH balance equation from water and taken over some of the hydroxides, will produce an excess amount of hydronium ion. Now the thing here is, if we take a look at this overall, we have reduced iron sulfide combining with oxygen, in this particular case H2 as well, and it actually forms this iron hydroxide. It's a bright red iron oxyhydroxide type compounds. These oxidized bright red colorful acid rock drainage colors that you see, bright red and orange, but also the production of 3 moles of hydronium ions and acid production. The problem is, as this continues to develop and pH drops below 3.5, you get another branch of reactions of direct oxidation, where we actually will produce from the ferric iron and water itself reduced iron plus sulfate, and here's 16 hydronium ions. And so acid rock drainage can be autocatalytic at these low pHs, driving the pH even lower. In highly impacted zones, believe it or not, you can actually get to negative pHs. In negative pHs in environmental waters are very destructive, not only because of their potential for acute lethality of any aquatic life that happened to alight in that particular water body, but it is also potentially self-sustaining because it is so acidic it can dissolve the minerals that it's in contact with. So what we find in terms of the end products, it results in the formation of soluble ferric sulfates and the production of acidity. So acid rock drainage is just that. It's acidic and it's a drainage that has heavy metal contaminants. There are elevated iron sulfate, high total dissolved solids, very low pHs, and all of this consortium of other metals that happens to be in this deposit. And so typically it's not just iron, it can be lead, zinc, mercury, and every other heavy metal that's associated with that deposit. If it's a lead mine, you will find lead in your ARD. It involves oxidation of ferrous iron to ferric iron. It does produce this acidity and the colorful iron oxyhydroxides. You need to know that although this is an abiotic process, it does interact with the sulfur cycle bacteria. I'll give you kind of a quick relationship diagram here. Typically, we can have in these reduced sulfur, we can have oxidizing bacteria, typically Thiobacillus thiooxidans types, that actually can oxidize the sulfide, which is S-2, to zero-valent sulfur and to sulfate, completing that cycle. If we have it actually go to an anaerobic zone, we can have SRBs, or sulfate-reducing bacteria, that can actually reduce this back down. If you recall the selenium biogeochemical cycle we put up here, this is a very similar cycle, and again has a lot to do with the ability of these types of microbes, in this case Thiobacillus thiooxidans and Desulfovibrio desulfotimaculum, to enhance the rates of either oxidation or reduction of these sulfur cycle processes. Next few slides, just to finish up here, I was just going to give you kind of a quick tour of some environments, and I talked about the fact that mineral species on terrestrial surfaces are in fact potentially oxidizable. So next time you see an orange rock, I want you to think acid rock drainage. Usually it's in control in terms of the normal buffering capacities of other minerals in there, but red rocks typically mean a weathering of an iron-based mineral and the local production, and it can be a very small-scale production of potential acidity. This is a mine portal. This is what happens when we have in the rock mining, deep underground mining, because when we have a portal, when we have a subsurface mine in the side of a mountain, for example, in this case, we essentially create a pathway for oxidation and a pathway for oxidized water to actually release some of the iron and some of the acidity. Waters like this pouring out of a mining portal can actually be highly acidic. They're not only colorful because of the iron oxyhydroxides, but they can be pH 3 or less. This gives you an idea of what can happen, especially because water flows according to its hydraulic gradient, and so if it's uphill, it's flowing downhill, and it can impact from a mining area to the natural waters around it, depositing and dissolving not only acidity, but also the heavy metals associated with that particular mining operation. This is an aerial view. Those of you that are from the west might recognize this as Butte, Montana. This is the Berkeley Pit Mine. We're going to be doing this as a case study in an environmental chemical series. This is a copper mine from Anaconda Copper that is right. This is downtown Butte right here. This is filling up at about several million gallons per day. That has the ability now to impact the drinking water system of Butte, Montana. This is highly acidic, pH 2, highly high level of dissolved heavy metals. It's the largest collection of contaminated water in the United States, and we'll talk about it in terms of using it as a reference in terms of what's happening there, what the risks are, the risk assessment, some of the processes that we are looking at to try to control man's impact next to a community that inarguably has benefited tremendously in the past century from mining activities. Well, next time what we'll do is we'll then take a separate tour. We'll talk about the environmental chemodynamics, why things happen in terms of environmental chemistry. This again is a continuation of our journey here looking at the chemical side of toxicology. Until next time, we'll see you. Thanks.